do go to bed angry. Much better to come at it with a refreshed, rational brain in the morning, especially because the tequila has probably worn off by then. Sarah writes, what I've learned is that no two relationships are the same. So protect your heart by just doing what's right for you and don't worry about what everyone else is doing. Samantha writes, give yourself the opportunity to miss each other. Obviously, spending time together is great, but I think it's really important not to lose sight of who you are as a person aside from being part of the couple. Tammy writes, people in good relationships never stop doing things for each other. Not necessarily big things, but little things, like scraping their windshield on a frosty morning, starting the coffee machine so it will be ready when they get up, making their favorite dessert, or even leaving a little love note somewhere they will come across it. 40. I just turned 40. I didn't think about it much beforehand because I'm not a birthday person, but aging is such a hot topic in Hollywood that simply surviving another year makes news, especially if you're entering a new decade. That's major. Breaking. Anna Faris had a birthday. Again. Didn't she just have one last year? Yep. But this is the big 4-0. Part of my ambivalence about my birthday has to do with the actual date, November 29. Growing up in Washington, November is the gloomiest, most depressing time of the year, and my birthday always falls right after Thanksgiving, so everyone is sick of their families. Chris, on the other hand, has the perfect birthday, June 21st. It's the summer solstice. School is just out, and everyone is getting ready for summer and celebrating. He just seems like the summer birthday type, doesn't he? The most annoying thing about turning 40 has most definitely been when people say, oh, the big 4-0. I just don't understand what that means. Am I supposed to be embarrassed? To feel different? It seems like one of those things that is a bigger deal to other people than it is to me, so perhaps I'm not honoring it enough on my end. There's an implication that I'm supposed to be freaking out, but I just don't feel old. I also don't think I look particularly old, but I don't really know what that means either. It's always odd when somebody says, oh my God, you don't look 40, and then they throw out another number. Sometimes it's crazy. You look like you're 23. But more often I'll get, you don't look 40, you look 37. And I just don't know how to take that. I know it's meant as a compliment, so I guess I'm grateful, but it's also confounding. First of all, in what ways do a 40-year-old and 37-year-old look different? Are those the key years where wrinkles and general old bagginess set in? And why is that a thing we're supposed to say to each other? Whenever someone mentions that they're 35 or 40 or 50, we automatically default to a compliment that is basically just, you look great for your decrepit, raggedy age. What is that about? I don't want to paint a perfect or perfectly enlightened picture around age. There are things about getting older that make me feel crappy. And then I, in turn, feel crappy about feeling crappy. I'm getting spider veins on the sides of my knees, and I've been dyeing my hair for so long that I probably have a head full of grays and don't even know it. Articles seem to note that Chris is younger than me, as if that's a robbing the cradle sort of thing because I've got a whopping 3 years on him. I used to have a cute butt, and now it sags to my knees. I wear sweatpants and boots and grubby t-shirts to work because I rehearse all day, so I constantly have to squash the catcalls. I don't want anybody telling me how sexy I am today, guys, I'll explain to the crew. It's too much. I can't handle it. Despite the spider veins and the maybe gray hair, the only time I've truly felt old since I turned 40 was when I went to the doctor. You're not 20, you're 40, she reminded me as she took my blood pressure. Stop thinking you're 20. Coming from a doctor, that's the moment when you're like, okay, fair point. So maybe the biological clock part reminds me that I'm not as young as I used to be. There's also the whole aging in Hollywood thing. Excuse me while my eyes glaze over. In a recent Washington Post article titled, Why the Age of 40 is So Important in Hollywood, the first line reads, Hollywood is a harsh place for women who dare to age. The article goes on to explain that 3/4 of leading roles for females go to women under 40. The depressing part about this article, because apparently that wasn't the depressing part, is that the research shows that Hollywood isn't really changing. Even as women have become vastly more visible in the workplace, the hiring patterns in Hollywood seem to be stuck in the 1960s, the author explains. When I got to Hollywood in the late 90s, everyone was lying about their age. Now there's a law that you can't even ask actors about their age, which is a little bit ridiculous, especially since, in this social media world, you can't really get away with keeping your age quiet. I have generally taken the opposite approach. I talk about my age all the time, especially on the podcast. I guess I feel like the best way to get control over it is by simply owning it. Otherwise, your age feels like the elephant in the room. That said, I make a concerted effort not to ask our female callers their age. Even if it seems relevant to their question, I don't want other women to get sucked into the time frame shit we've all had to deal with forever. Am I scared of getting older? Sometimes, sure. Am I scared of people saying I don't look as good as I used to? Fuck yeah. Would I like to have been born in 1992? Okay, I would. But I've got plenty of other things to be grateful for. I'll be honest. It doesn't feel great to work really hard for nearly 20 years in this town and then worry you won't get hired again because you're no longer fuckable. I would like to think that women want to see a man and a woman of a similar age having a romance. In a moment of insecurity, I have definitely asked Chris, as you have more and more influence in casting your movies, will you think about someone closer to Rachel McAdams' age? She's 38. Because today, it's still completely usual to have a 15-year difference and nobody bats an eye. As long as the man is the older one, that is. But I'm not without hope. After a couple of decades in which Hollywood casted quite young, I feel a shift, regardless of what that article says. I'm suddenly getting really nice offers, and I like to think that that's because of the strength of women at the box office. There are a lot of highly accomplished actresses in my age range who continue to work and act and carry movies. And I do think that simply because I've hung in the game for so long, people realize that I'm not going anywhere. So they think, we can't get rid of her. Might as well work together on some shit. That's been one of the perks of comedy, too. It allows for women to have longevity. I won't be the leading lady always. I'll become the auntie and the stepmom and mom and then maybe grandma. I'll do all the normal transitions, but if people will still hire me, then I don't mind that shift. There's a lot of liberation in playing supporting characters and not the lead. Age is also less limiting in today's Hollywood world because actors have the ability to do other creative things. Performers who are ambitious can figure out other avenues, writing or teaming up with a producing partner or writing books or doing podcasts. Seth Rogen and his team are a perfect example of that thought process. Okay, if they're not going to hire me, how do I generate my own material? It's what happened to me with the House Bunny. I thought, I'm not sure where my next opportunity will come, so maybe I should just create it. And so I developed a film about a lovable Playboy Bunny house mom. There have been some joys in aging. One of the greatest gifts about getting older has been developing a newfound confidence. I feel more comfortable in my skin, and thus more comfortable being self-deprecating and boisterous at the same time. In my 20s, I felt a constant need to prove myself, so anytime I was the butt of the joke, even when it was my own doing, I would simultaneously try to remind everyone to take me seriously. Back then, I hadn't quite figured out what it meant to be a leader, either. I wanted to harness the power I was given on the sets where I was in a prominent position, but I didn't know how to do it right. It actually took Keenan Ivory Wayans delivering a bit of a wake-up call for me to realize how and when to pick my battles. While we were working together on Scary Movie 2, there was a stunt coordinator on set who was really hard on all our stunt performers. I had become friends with all of them, and they would complain to me about this guy all the time. He worked them incredibly long hours and didn't seem to care about their injuries, and I felt like I potentially had the power to stand up for them. They didn't ask me to do this, but I approached Keenan, who was the creator and director of the movie. He's been mean and cruel and abusive to the stunt people, and I don't like it, I said. These were people I was rehearsing with every day. It wasn't a group of people I saw for only, like, 20 minutes every now and then. I wanted to fight for them. You know what, Keenan said? I think this is your battle. I was a little stung by that, but I also remember thinking that now if I didn't go to this guy, Keenan would know that I was being wimpy and just running to the daddy figure on set. And so the next day, I asked the stunt coordinator if we could talk after lunch. My heart was pounding, and I was so nervous. Not sure if you know this by now, but confrontation is not my strong suit. But we went for a walk, and I said awkwardly, I feel like you can be really mean to some of the people you work with, and I think you may not realize that I feel it, but I do. I really like you and respect you, but I'm not sure what else to do at this point. It was one of my first adult conversations, and he was awesome about it, thanking me for coming to him and seemingly taking what I said to heart. Now that I'm reflecting on it, Keenan and this guy were pretty good friends, so maybe he was warned ahead of time. Anna's going to come to you and say you're mean, Keenan probably said. Be sweet to her. But he was sweet, and it taught me an important lesson. I was looking to Keenan to be my defender and protector, even though I wasn't the one who needed protecting. I just wanted to assert my power because I was 23 and didn't know better. The stunt coordinator, on the other hand, was in his mid-30s, and I was definitely a little intimidated by him. In hindsight, it was a conversation that probably wasn't mine to have. While he worked me hard and did a lot of training with me to get me in shape, he was never rude to me personally. It was just that I heard from people who were becoming my friends about how cruel he was, and I felt I had the power to make a change. I don't know how I would handle that situation today, because I'm not sure it was my battle to fight back then, and I don't like to pick a fight just to pick a fight. But I'm grateful to have had that uncomfortable conversation, because those talks are part of growing up. Whether it's about leaving your agent or talking to your director or co-star or something else completely unrelated to Hollywood. There are many degrees of confrontation that I haven't always known how to navigate in a way that is practical, but also forceful enough to ensure I'm heard. Today, I approach my on-set leadership role very differently. I consider it to be largely my responsibility to create an air of positivity among everyone working on Mom. I have a routine on set every Friday before we tape the show where I make an announcement to the crew. Now that we're in season 5, they all laugh before I even start talking because they know what I'm going to say. It goes something like this. Hey, everybody, I have an announcement. I just want to tell you guys all how much I love you and what an amazing team we are. You are the best. I feel so lucky that I get to drive to work knowing that I'm going to see you. It's literally the same exact 4 sentences every week. It sounds so minor, but I never would have thought to do that in my 20s. It wouldn't have occurred to me because I was too self-absorbed to turn the spotlight on other people, and I wasn't comfortable enough in a leadership position to realize that I could use it to establish a positive atmosphere. Plus, I would have worried that everyone was thinking, "Who is this young kid telling us she loves us?" I took myself seriously because I wanted other people to do the same. Now that I'm older, I know that speech may be stupid, but at least I can own it and laugh at myself. Why not spread the love, even if it means that I come across as an idiot? And I do like spreading the love. I think I was always a nice person, but I've become more overtly kind as I've aged. I feel more generous. Some people see that as being a pushover, and in some cases my aversion to drama is perceived as weakness, which seems like a weird reaction. People have asked me why I don't stand up for myself more often, but I do when I feel the need to. I just don't feel that need very often. And in Hollywood, standing up for yourself is often code for making unreasonable demands and generally being a diva. I don't need my kale pear juice freshly squeezed and hand-delivered to me every morning. I can get my own juice. That doesn't seem like something that warrants a fit. There's so much childish coddling of actors in our industry. There's a pattern where actors are treated like children and therefore behave like children, and that's why there are 8 people whose job it is to literally track down where we are at all times. It's crazy because you'd think an adult would know how to be where they're supposed to be, on time, or how to hold their bladder when necessary, or be hungry for a minute without needing immediate attention. I know I'm supposed to be on set at 9 a.m., and so I should be on set at 9 a.m., and someone shouldn't have to knock on my door and say, "Hey, we'd like to invite you to set now." Those are the actual words they use in Hollywood, no matter what you're filming. "We'd like to invite you to set." It's kind of ridiculous. So I don't think the fact that I don't need everything on demand makes me a pushover. I think it makes me a self-sufficient adult. A common theme of hitting a certain age, especially among women, is the tendency, or at least the desire, to be a bit tougher and give up on the people-pleasing. But the reality is that I struggle with being a people-pleaser, and I don't think that's something I can change in myself. I like to think I'm shifting away from the constant need to be liked, but sometimes I enjoy doing things because they will make other people happy. I want to give a compliment just because I do, not because I'll get anything in return. Which isn't to say I'm not vain and I don't love hearing nice things about me. Of course I am, and of course I do. But giving other people small moments of pleasure, I get a kick out of it. Looking back at my 30s, they were definitely a time of great growth and an influx of confidence and happiness. I married Chris and had Jack and joined Mom and started my podcast. It felt like my career had a different kind of resurgence, one that I actually had some control over with movies like The House Bunny and What's Your Number? My 20s were about projects like Scary Movie and The Hot Chick, in which I had zero creative input. I was along for somebody else's ride. But in my 30s, I got to have more creative control. Or maybe it was just that I was more proactive and people took me more seriously. I don't know, but it was great. So I hope that in my 40s, I get to continue on that path. I'd like to produce more too, so I'm hoping that those doors will open and interesting roles will present themselves as well. But more interesting than my 40s, I think, is thinking about when I'm 60 and imagining what that looks like. I'd like to live in Washington, and I'll have built a little amphitheater. Well, John the artist down the street will have built it, but I'll have cheered him on, and have a grumpy pet pony who bites sometimes but loves me anyway. And I'll channel Annette Bening, who is the most stunning, almost 60-year-old in existence. My strategy will be to fake it till I make it and just be brimming with sexual confidence. I've got 20 years to get there. Unqualified advice. How to tune out the noise. One of the most common issues that Sim and I hear from callers into the podcast has to do with dealing with outside pressure. To get married, to have a kid, to have a second kid, whatever it is. We had one caller, Bree, who had recently finished her PhD. She was the only person in her family to graduate college, let alone to get an advanced degree, and she was also a successful dance teacher. But all Bree's husband's family cared about, she said, was whether she was going to have a baby. She and her husband, who happened to be her high school sweetheart, had agreed they didn't want kids, but the incessant questions from her in-laws were pissing her off and making her question her husband's happiness in their marriage. The call made me sad for a number of reasons, mostly because I know that so many women deal with that kind of pressure every day. For me, it's the question of a second kid. I get it mostly from the press. I'm an easy red carpet target if I'm out with my family. It's so obvious for a journalist to say, "I saw the cutest Instagram of you with your son Jack. Are you going to have another?" Part of me wants to just say, "Please fuck off." But I try to be straightforward in those conversations. So I just say, "I would love to have more kids." And if I'm feeling saucy, I'll say, "But I'm getting up there," just to make myself laugh and because it makes people uncomfortable once you bring age into it. That's when then they realize that, oh, maybe I've intruded too much. There's no question that women are strapped to a timeline, and one that is largely dictated by outside forces. The silver lining, if you really look for it, is that the timeline can make you even more career-driven and focused, cultivating an eye-on-the-prize mentality that was a benefit to me. But the downside is that when you're with your boyfriend of 7 years, people are like, "When are you going to put a ring on it?" First of all, it's weird to call someone an it, but also, maybe you don't want to get married. Or maybe you're not in a rush. I've gotten better at tuning out the noise as I've gotten older, but I've definitely been guilty of falling victim to the timeline. In my 20s, I demanded a timeline from everything in my life. It helped me hustle around this town and get work, but it also led me to a marriage that I shouldn't have been in. It's so odd that men don't have that same pressure. Or maybe some do, but for them, it's probably more career-based. But the stoner dudes I grew up with in Seattle, our conversations were like, me. "Are you going to class?" Stoner dude. "I don't know." Me. "It's starting right now." Stoner dude. "Yeah, I don't know." Me, internally. "Make up your mind already. I can't deal with your indecision." The major fear with the timeline and the outside pressure to conform to it is that you could end up warping yourself and conforming to another person's agenda. Then you'll inevitably feel frustrated when you aren't getting what you truly want. Imagine if every other day different people asked you, "When are you going to Madagascar? When are you going to Madagascar? But seriously, have you decided when you're going to Madagascar? So wait, when? When are you going to go?" Suddenly you're like, "I didn't even know I wanted to, but maybe I do. Yeah, I guess pretty soon. I'm going on the trip of my dreams. I'm saving up for Madagascar. So we need to maintain perspective, but I don't think there's an easy way to tune out the noise. If someone asks you, so, what are you thinking about kids? You could always pull a highbrow cultural analysis saying, have you ever thought about how there seems to be a timeline for women that doesn't exist for men? Why do you think that is? You know, make people uncomfortable with your clever sociological conundrums. But the truth is that I don't think there's a snappy answer for those intrusive questions, and it's a fruitless effort to try and stop them entirely. You can't change other people, and it's so ingrained in our culture that calling them out will only make you both uncomfortable. So I think the answer is just having people in your life that you trust and having friends who love and support you, ones you can talk to about this stuff, because having a dialogue helps relieve the pressure. Or you can self-deflect like I do and just say, I know, I'm getting old. Maybe my vagina's just not tight enough anymore to hold a baby. Friday, January 6th, 2017. 8:07 a.m. Woke up with a jolt because I forgot to set my alarm and Jack has to get to school and he's still asleep. Normally, he crawls into bed with me around 4, so I get up and drink tea while he snoozes in my bed. Today I get him up and he groans and then responds to my nudges with a toot in my face. Not sure when Jack's breath and flatulence started smelling like a grown-up's, but we've crossed that bridge. Chris snuck out early to work out and head to a day of meeting, so I don't see him. 8:30. Jack's nanny took him to school since I was running late. I'm not a breakfast person. I'll eat some cereal sometimes, but I really don't care for breakfast food. I would have a turkey sandwich or a burger for breakfast every day if I could. On show days, we tape Mom on Friday evenings. I get amped, and the nervous energy kind of kills my appetite. Usually, I'm a late-night eater. When Chris is gone, I'll watch Netflix in bed and eat a giant bowl of pasta with oil and cheese, which I love. When he's here, I get a little embarrassed chomping down on an entire meal at 10:30. 9:56. Just took an exercise walk around the neighborhood, which I haven't done in a long time. I wore a cute workout outfit, so it looked like I was really working out, but instead of making it the full 4 miles, I called it at a half mile. 10:03. I should be looking at my script and calling my dad and my manager and showering, but I'm watching old episodes of Louie. Man, it's good. 10:20. I take quick showers, but I love my getting ready time, especially drying my hair, because that's when I read the newspaper. I've got extensions, a lovely perk of having a child is thinning hair, which take a long time to dry. So on really busy days, this feels like my only quiet personal time. 10:56. Headed to Warner Brothers, stage 20. It's still a thrill to be able to park on the lot instead of walking on holding pages for an audition. 11:10. Arrive at work for show taping day. We tape in front of a live studio audience, which is fun, but adds an element of nerves to taping days. 11:15. Allison is here early too. Always love seeing her. We get our coffee and gossip instead of rehearsing our lines like we should. 12:05. Our sweet but very anxious PA is pacing back and forth, which is making me crazy. 12:31. About to start camera blocking for the show. I give myself a solid B for knowing my lines, but I still got a few hours before we tape. 1:10, bathroom break. Not that exciting. 1:16, Allison is taking a bathroom break now. She says she won't share any details. 2:50, in the middle of a run-through with the producers. It's super stressful because it's our final rehearsal, but I have a scene off, so I'm writing this. Also, my hair is green, so I have to go get it dechlorinated during my break. Bleach blondes will understand. 3:05. Finished run through with producers and writers. It's a nervous time for everyone, but it was successful. I didn't fuck up once. 3:15. Headed to hair and makeup to get patched up. 4:00. It's our dinner break, and I've got a fried chicken salad, but I'm too anxious to eat much, even though it's delicious. I've done enough tapings at this point that you would think it'd be second nature, but I still get nervous every week. 5:36. Chris and Jack are here. It's the first time Jack has come to a live taping. He's most interested in the coconut cake on the craft service table. It's hard to get him to be polite to my coworkers, but he's doing his best. 6 o'clock. The actors huddle in hair and makeup with the script supervisor and do the whole show as fast as we can without our script. Depending on people's levels of preparedness, sometimes it's rocky and sometimes it's 10 minutes. It's never longer than a half hour. Then they hustle us straight to our intros to the live studio audience. The announcer calls our names and we run out and say hello to the crowd, who is usually really welcoming. That helps establish the energy, but it's also when the anxiety of the show starts to hit. 6:30. Start taping. I always say doing TV, especially a multi-cam sitcom like Mom, is like doing a really fun version of the SATs. It requires a different kind of mental concentration. You only get 2 shots, because we only really do 2 takes for each scene. It's somewhere between improv, which is only 1 shot, but tedious in its own way, and a single-cam show like Parks and Rec, in which they do 10 to 20 takes. 9:30. We used to have big parties with the cast and crew in my dressing room after each taping, but I think now that we're in season 5, we've all sort of grown out of that. Tonight, I'm too tired after the taping to hang out, so I head home. Chris and Jack went home about halfway through, and Jack is already asleep when I get back. 10 o'clock. Every Friday night, I get the script for the show we'll start working on next week, which feels completely overwhelming, but also exciting. I usually stay up late on Fridays to see what's coming up and to get ready for the process to start all over again with Monday's table read. We have rehearsals on Tuesday and Wednesday, and on Thursday we do pre-shoots, scenes that take place outside or are especially emotional or difficult to tape in front of a live audience. Mondays and Tuesdays I come home and go straight to podcasting, which is wonderful, but of course means I can't exercise or take Jack to the park or do anything for myself. It's a passion project, but also time-consuming. 11 o'clock. I usually go to bed pretty early. Fridays are my late night. It takes me a minute to mentally wind down, so I wash my face and watch Real Housewives and basically zone out until I crash. She Said, He Said, What It's Like to Be a Couple in Hollywood. Chris and I have been working actors for as long as we've known each other. We've shared the spotlight plenty, and there have been times when one of us stepped aside to let the other one have their moment. It's probably not unlike what happens in most relationships, just on a more public scale. We talked about navigating Hollywood as a couple. I say, I guess I was the more well-known of us when we first met, though I've never really felt all that famous. But when we first started dating, you were not quite as successful as you are now. I knew you would be, though. I was taken by your talent immediately, because I'd never worked with anyone as good as you. The only other person who struck me like that was Ryan Reynolds, when we did our scenes together in Just Friends or Waiting. I would think, he's making me rise to the challenge. But you and I were playing boyfriend and girlfriend, so it was a romantic scenario on screen and, obviously, eventually off screen too. In Take Me Home Tonight, there was that scene where we were supposed to kiss, and you suggested that I leap up onto you and straddle my legs around you, and I did it. And I'm really self-conscious about that sort of thing, and you slapped my ass a bit. I was so struck by your confidence. I couldn't believe you just went for it like that. It was totally appropriate, because we were playing characters at a high school party who had been together for a couple of years, but you were taking control of the scene in a way that I completely admired. I also found it terrifying. I was mystified by you. So, the point is, you weren't a household name yet, but I knew it was coming. Chris says, well, thank you. I remember there was a moment a while back when a friend of mine who worked in social media put my name into something that was like a star meter, and it said the most famous I'd ever been at that point was when I got engaged to you. Our engagement made my star meter go up or something, and I remember him laughing and thinking that was so funny. And it did make me feel a little weird, if I'm being honest. At that point, the most fame I'd ever seen was when I did the 4th season of The OC. I'd managed to be a working actor, but I didn't have any notoriety or real recognition from it. I was early on in my career at that point, and mine began totally differently than yours did. You crushed it right away and hit it big right out of the gate. I didn't have that. And there were definitely moments when I felt like Jason Segel's character in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, like the boyfriend who held the purse on the sidelines and people didn't really see me. Not that you ever made me feel like that. It was the people you introduced me to. Actors would have their hands all over you and call you babe, and you would say, "This is my boyfriend, Chris," and I'd get a quick head nod, and then they'd turn back to you. But that's the nature of Hollywood, to be honest. Relationships here have an element of mutual benefits to them. So even in social interactions, there is that question of, how can this person help me? In that sense, people gravitated more toward you because you meant more to their dreams. You were a star. What's funny is that more than being annoyed about that treatment, I just kind of felt like they weren't in on it yet. I've always been weirdly overconfident, so I thought, okay, that's cool. There's going to be a day when I've had more success and I'm going to remember these moments and these people. And I say, that's how I felt when I first met you. Like I was in on something. I was proud of myself for that. Like I finally have good taste in men. But also I knew I saw something that everyone else would too, and it was just a matter of time. I give myself a lot of credit for seeing it before everyone else did. Like that opening scene of Guardians of the Galaxy when you are dancing with so much joy. I saw that and thought, oh my God, that is so fucking cool and fearless. Chris says, but I saw your star continue to rise after we got together too. It wasn't like you were some has-been. You had done Scary Movie, but not the house bunny, so watching that happen was great. You were pitching it all over town, not just to star in it, but to produce it. I couldn't believe it when it happened. It was so cool to watch somebody take an idea and find a partner and go out on the town and get something made. I'd only heard about that, never actually seen it. So to watch it firsthand, I was so impressed. I get questions from journalists a lot asking how we deal with each other's success. People are curious. It's a natural instinct to assume that the competitive nature of what we do would translate to resentment of each other's careers and even resentment in our lives together. But the good news is that, and I guess I can only speak for myself, but I think we both have pretty impenetrable egos. And I say, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I don't have the career that I used to, and I do have moments of insecurity about that. I'm so thrilled and grateful that you are doing the things you are, and I have crazy pride in the fact that your talents are recognized. But it can be hard not to have a moment of self-doubt when my husband is acting with young women in big movies and I'm playing a role in Mom that, while I love it, is incredibly unsexy. Chris says, I felt that way when I auditioned for What's Your Number? I really wanted to play the role Andy Samberg was cast in, and instead I got Disgusting Donald. And I tested for the Chris Evans role. But the truth is, in the grand scheme of things, you might feel that self-doubt in this exact moment, but it's going to be a blink of the eye and this will all be over. That's why it's important for both of us to keep our feet on the ground. Because this is all going to go away one day, and the torch will be passed. If we're lucky, we get 1 second of success, and some people get 2 or 3. But it all comes crashing to a halt eventually, because fame and notoriety, it's all fake. You have to keep your eye on the prize, because it's all an illusion. And I say, of course that's true, and that's very rational of you, and I am really happy to celebrate your celebrity. Like when we're in a restaurant and someone asks to take a picture with you and hands me the camera, mostly I love it. The arrogant part of me thinks, I found somebody who I saw complete potential in, and I'm so proud of him and proud of myself for knowing before everyone else. See how I make it about me? And the vain part of me is happy not to be in anyone's Facebook photo when I'm in my sweats and no makeup. And the good person part of me thinks it's nice to be able to make a fan's day with a quick photo. But truth be told, it's not like I don't walk away with, say, 4% of a sting. It's not much at all, but I wouldn't want the dear listeners of this book to think I'm immune to it when, after the fact, the people in the picture are like, oh, we like you too, but we don't really want your photo. It would be dishonest to pretend that no part of me has a moment of questioning myself. Does this mean I'm irrelevant? Even though I really would much rather take the photo than be in it. That doesn't mean I feel any resentment toward you. I don't. I've gotten such joy in watching your crazy ascension to stardom, and mostly I get a kick out of it. I don't know. It's a great industry to be in for a number of reasons, but it also really messes with your head sometimes. And Chris says, well, the photo thing is just weird, and we've both had that. You're kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, especially when we're together. If you assume that someone wants you in the photo, you're weird and kind of full of yourself. If you assume they don't, you run the risk of them saying, get in, which can also be awkward. The only right way to deal with it is to be patient and polite and do what you can to smile and be grateful and then keep moving. And I say, I like to think that plenty of couples deal with these same issues, don't you think? Not the picture taken necessarily, but there are always moments when one half of the couple has the spotlight a little more than the other. Whether it's career success or a personal achievement, there have to be moments when it might take a little bit of checking your ego to let the other person have their glory and not say, what about me? And Chris says, yeah, but I think you just focus on what you can control. Keep working hard. Things change in an instant. In our industry, you can look at people who just a few years ago were everywhere, and now that's not the case. So I think for any couple, you just have to remember that the only thing inevitable is change, and all you can do is not compare yourself to anybody else. Focus on everything in your control to make that change be something that is moving toward making you better. We're in show business, so for us, it's our career or our ability as actors, but for other people, it might be something else. But change is coming. So how do you make it a good change? It's all about how you feel about something. If it's good, enjoy the good, because you know it could go away any minute. And if it's bad, celebrate the fact that that's going away soon too. Unqualified advice. I don't know what I'm talking about, but here's some other free, or only the cost of this book, unqualified advice. I seem to have thoughts on everything, dating related or not, really, so I wanted to gather a few more bits of advice here. These don't warrant their own chapter, I don't think, but think of it like my little compendium of unqualified theories. On snooping. All signs point to me being a snoop. I'm a curious person who wants to hear other people's stories and problems and life plans. But one thing I've learned from friends who have dealt with it is that snooping is always the worst idea. Not a bad idea, the worst idea. I must have had some inkling of this even as a child. You know how some kids rifle through the usual hiding spots to get an early glimpse of their Christmas gifts? That wasn't me. I knew where my mom kept the presents, but I never looked. I don't think I ever really dug much into my parents' things at all. Note to self, send this chapter to mom. That's not to say I'm necessarily respectful of people's privacy. I just want to hear their business from their own mouths. I bring this up because so many of the calls into our podcast start with, I know I shouldn't have, but I peeked at his text messages. Or, my friend looked through her husband's emails. So this is my public service announcement. Just don't do it. I get why it's enticing, especially now in a world where there are so many places where you can snoop. When I was a kid, we didn't have Facebook or email or text messages. You couldn't log onto someone's secret Tinder account or check their call log. You could only listen in on landline phone conversations or read someone's letters. It wasn't like it is today, where as soon as you earn enough trust that someone tells you their password, you can use that against them. Here's the thing about snooping. It can only lead you to bad places. Either you find out something you don't want to know, or you find out something exciting, he bought a ring, and then you've ruined the surprise. There's no good outcome. If you think your boyfriend is cheating on you, for example, not finding an email to another girl isn't going to convince you he's faithful. It'll probably just convince you he has a secret email account. Like I said, no good outcome. When Chris and I first moved in together, I didn't even want to go through his pockets when I was doing his laundry. Not that I suspected him of anything, I just knew that the curiosity could lead me down a path I didn't want to travel. What if some girl at the gym gave him her number and he threw it in his pocket to be polite? I'd probably think he was cheating on me. So I made a policy that I just don't look. Here's the other thing about snooping. As soon as you get found out, you've lost most of your power in the relationship, whether it's a romantic one or a friendship or family. And if you're in a girlfriend-boyfriend situation, that will always hang over you. It will be ammo the other person will use against you, should it come to that. Protect yourself. Don't snoop. And when Christmas comes, find a better hiding place. The 60-40 rule. People say that relationships should be an equal partnership, but it's rare that a relationship is ever actually 50-50, even a friendship. A healthy balance, I think, is more like 60-40. There's always going to be someone who needs something different from what you need, sometimes more, sometimes less. You probably won't ever both give and get the same amount. The good news, as I see it, is that the 60-40 fluctuates. Sometimes you're the 60, other times you're the 40. But you need to always feel one of two ways. Either one, I think I'm giving more than I'm getting right now, but just a little bit more, and what I'm getting still makes me feel really good. Or two, I know I'm asking for a lot right now, and I don't have time to give of myself in the same way, but that will change soon, and I'll step up. The important thing to remember is that there's no end to any of it. There's no, I did my part, I'll take it easy now. While it's normal for relationships to stray from 50-50, they really should stay at 60-40. If yours goes to 70-30 or 80-20, it's potentially doomed. That's the relationship orange alert. The different colors of terror threats are basically impossible to remember. Orange is the high alert, FYI. I know that because I just Googled it. Red is severe. What are we supposed to do when we get a red alert? I don't see how knowing we're on severe terror alert is helpful other than inspiring widespread panic. I guess that's why I don't work in national security. We talk to a lot of people on the podcast who have veered into 70-30 territory. They admit that they're unhappy the majority of the time, and they blame themselves for it. I always think that maybe those people should take a closer look at their relationship and why they're feeling such a high level of inequality. If you're doing all of the childcare and the housework and holding a job, but the other person makes you feel good, then great. That's awesome. But if you're doing all that and you get nothing in return, no help, and also no good feelings, then that relationship probably won't and shouldn't last. Spotting a cheat. Here's a line I've heard three times from three different guys. I just want to tell you something happened last night. Amanda/Sarah/Brandy/whoever tried to kiss me. I told her no, I'm in a relationship, but I just thought you should know. Translation? I fucked Amanda/Sarah/Brandy/whoever. At least that's my theory. She tried to kiss me is a preemptive manipulation tactic to get ahead of any rumors that might start swirling. It's a perfect way for the cheating guy to divert attention away from himself and pit woman against woman instead. It's a strategy that's not unrelated to all the terminology we use to set up women as villains. Mistress, homewrecker, gold digger. See, Teen Mom, Teen Mom 2, and so on. I love these shows. My mom is appalled by them and by the fact that I watch them, but they really are the best birth control. It's easy to believe that she tried to kiss me line, if you want to. I know, because I've been in the position of believing ridiculous stories when it was easier than facing the truth. Take the summer before college, when I was hanging out in a car getting stoned with Chad Burke and some other kids when this gal named Sarah said, "Ugh, I did not sleep at all last night because I was mashed up against Chad's wall." We were all so high that I don't think she realized what she said into the long, awkward silence that followed. Suddenly, she looked at me with wide eyes that screamed, "What the fuck did I just say?" I broke out of my stoner brain just long enough to think, great, everyone knew that Chad is screwing Sarah except me. But I never confronted him about it. I didn't want to feel like a fool. And I remember sort of wanting to believe that maybe she just didn't have a place to sleep. I didn't want to accept that he was cheating because I didn't want to deal with what that meant, which was that I'd probably have to break up with him. In cheating scenarios, you have to weigh the punishment to yourself against the punishment to the other person, and I didn't want to deal with what I'd be doing to myself, ending the relationship with a shitty guy who I had some kind of cult worship for. There have been other times when I've believed the "she tried to kiss me" line because, again, it seemed easier to believe a lie than to act on the truth. But the reality is that while there are aggressive women, how many women do you know who actually try to kiss a guy out of nowhere? Especially one they know is in a relationship. Oh, you found yourself alone outside smoking a cigarette and she lunged at you out of nowhere and you said, "I'm sorry, I could never betray my girlfriend." And then you thought you should tell me because it was just the right thing to do? I call bullshit. You should too. Go to bed angry. This was the best piece of relationship advice my brother ever gave me. He was going through a tough breakup a long time ago, and he'd been with someone whose relationship mantra was to never go to bed angry. While that relationship was ending, he said to me, "Anna, just go to bed angry. It's fine." And he was so right. In general, I think women like quick resolutions and for a fight to be over as soon as possible. It's never comfortable to go to bed with an unsettled feeling or with disagreements unresolved. But men, in my experience, need to work off their testosterone, maybe with a hard workout or a night of sleep. Trying to negotiate a fight quickly does not always benefit both parties, and rushing through an issue is not always the best solution. That's not to say I don't believe in talking things out, but you need to wait until a little time has passed. In the moment, there is too much irrationality, and that's when the really damaging things are said that cannot be taken back. So give each other a little space and go to sleep, even if you're pissed off. Let time do some of the healing. This is the chapter that will make you vomit. I have been witness to romantic gestures, big and small, all my life. My dad is a romantic guy, and he and my mom were never shy about putting their love on display. My brother Bob, same thing. And I wouldn't be honoring my relationship with Chris if I didn't acknowledge that he was great at grand gestures, but also stellar at the tiny ones. And I think both can have equal impact. I decided to list my most favorite of these gestures, those I've received and those I've seen exchanged between people I love, all in one place. So you can just skip this chapter altogether if it makes you want to puke. But before you do, let me give you one caveat. While I'm conscious of the fact that this kind of sentimentality might be rare, I think every man has his own way of showing love. So while your partner may not display his affection by doing your hair, make a point to notice whatever it is he does that makes you feel special. Number one, braiding hair. My mom loves to French braid my hair. It's a weird thing she does even now that I'm an adult, but she always starts a little too high and I end up looking like a sister wife. 3 or 4 years ago, Chris was watching her do a French braid and wanted to learn. He already knew how to do a regular braid because his sister taught him when they were kids, and he's into knots in general from being an outdoorsy guy. I know it's weird for somebody to be into knots, but for example, he loved it when I had a tangled piece of jewelry. I don't have the patience for detangling necklaces, but Chris finds it satisfying, or meditative, I guess. He also loves doing a Rubik's Cube, which is not the same at all, but somehow seems related. So anyway, he started giving me French braids. We'd be in bed at night watching football, and he'd say, "Let me braid your hair." And I would sit between his legs and let him do my hair. He was always the instigator. It happened less as I got older because I've had a lot of hair issues, and I have extensions, so it's harder and less satisfying, and I have weird lumps in my scalp, but I still got braids from time to time. Just check Chris's Instagram, where he bragged that real men braid. He cuts Jack's hair, too. They play barber together. Chris is a great caretaker in general, but especially when it comes to hair. Number two, speaking of hair. My mom has cut my dad's hair since he was in the Army in 1970. Doing an Army cut was easy, but she's kept up with it since through plenty of hairstyles. My dad sits in the kitchen in his underwear, and she carefully cuts what remains of his hair, and it's oddly intimate and romantic. Then she sweeps up the floor while he showers and shampoos. It's funny because I also remember wandering into the kitchen as a kid every 3 weeks and smelling bleach, because my father would be bleaching my mother's hair at the kitchen counter. What is it about hair? My parents have always been very adoring toward each other, with tons of pet names. Precious Angel, Dreamboat, Mrs. Drubowski, I have no idea where that came from, Darling Pies, and my dad constantly telling my mom how beautiful she is. She gets embarrassed by it, but it's a wonderful gesture, and one I was lucky to grow up around. Number three, poems, letters, and other handwritten notes. Chris wrote me poems and sent me letters from wherever he was in the world, on hotel stationery. So I'd get a letter from a gorgeous hotel in Moscow or Paris or wherever work took him, though he was usually home by the time they arrived. They were like old-timey war letters that said things like, "Honey, I'm dreaming of the day I get to hold you again." For such a dude, he's really thoughtful. He's also a really good artist and drew me pictures on our mirror. About a year and a half ago, he drew a picture of himself on our bathroom mirror with a love note, and the picture looks remarkably like him. He also wrote me a long poem once that was framed in our home. Do you want to throw up yet? Number four, big risks. My brother Bob is a believer that real romance lies in big moves. Ones that are risky, costly, and could easily backfire, but that leave you transformed either way. When he and my sister-in-law were dating, he decided to surprise her with a trip to Oahu during what he describes as a rocky period in their relationship. I know that whisking someone away to Hawaii sounds foolproof on the surface, but they were already going through a rough patch, so this was the kind of trip that could make or break them. Bob mistakenly booked what turned out to be a shitty hotel on Waikiki Beach. Think wilted microwave sausages and freeze-dried eggs served on styrofoam plates. Not the romantic healing getaway he was hoping for. It was turning into one of those risks that didn't pay off, until Bob was able to convince the hotel he had a family emergency, get a refund on their prepaid stay, and transfer to a beautiful romantic hotel. They had a magical 4 days driving around the island, picnicking, and swimming on secluded beaches. Now they're married with a beautiful baby girl. I've always been touched by that story, because that kind of big bet is scary when it comes to relationships. He put it all on the line, and I'm so glad it paid off. Number 5, flowers. Every Friday before mom tapings, Chris sent me a giant bouquet of flowers at the studio. I'll admit that sometimes I felt almost embarrassed, not because I wanted to hide them, but I didn't want to always be the look what I got girl who rubbed her romantic husband in her coworkers' faces. But yeah, a giant bouquet of flowers in my dressing room wasn't bad. Don't call it closure. I started seeing a therapist after I began writing this book. I was raised thinking therapy was for the self-indulgent or mentally ill. I could be both. But re-examining my life and revisiting past loves and getting ready to publicize those experiences, all that has dug up a lot of shit, which shouldn't come as too big of a surprise. I thought I was revealing my stories to help other people feel less alone, but instead it has inspired a hearty dose of introspection that I think has benefited me. At least that's what my new therapist, who's very positive and friendly and knows everything about football and always tells me I'm doing great, says. At her hourly rate, I have to believe her. Though this book is largely about relationships, it has forced me to examine so many different aspects of my life. Somehow this whole journey has made me want to do more. Broadway, producing. It has stoked my ambitions in a way I never expected. I recently filmed a remake of Overboard, and while it may sound dramatic to say that it changed me, it really did. The work was incredibly difficult, but I was able to do all kinds of improv, and I felt giddy the whole time. It was so creatively rewarding. Life is messy. I obviously don't have all the answers. When I first started thinking about writing this book, I pictured myself sitting on my bed with a cup of coffee all, la 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 la, here's something funny I thought about yesterday, is it funny to you? It became much more than that. In the end, I hope that it has made some people laugh and made other people feel like they're not crazy, or at least that they're just as crazy as I am, so they know they're not alone. So to all of you out there who dedicated time to reading or listening to this book, well, the phrase, I'm not worthy, is bouncing around in my head. It would be really fucked up if it weren't, though, if writing a book about yourself is completely natural and easy and you don't have a moment where you wonder, why would anyone care? Then you've drunk way too much of your own Kool-Aid. If there's one thing I'm grateful for, it's that this book is called Unqualified. I don't have everything figured out, and I don't think I ever will. I couldn't even conceive of the feeling of being qualified. Feeling unqualified is in my build. It's hard-coded in my DNA. I'll never not feel fear when I put myself out there, but that's okay. I'll keep doing things I have no right to do because I don't like wading in the shallow end. I'd rather get pushed into the deep end and then attempt to touch the bottom. That's just how I operate. Remember the orange ceremony? My attempt at closure with Jason Sprott, the fastest boy in third grade, where I wrote his name on an orange and threw it into the forest? These days, I take comfort in the belief that there's no such thing as closure. As my family is evolving, I hope we can still have barbecues and 4th of July celebrations and that we can proceed forward with love and tenderness. There is no finish line when it comes to relationships, and I think the search for one will just make you frustrated. So I have no illusions that this book is done and now I can close the door on my past. I do feel like this book is done, so Let's keep moving and focus on the future. I'm excited to see what will come next. Because a great family and career isn't the end either. There's always work to be done. But the thing that writing this book has really taught me, above all else, is how limited my vocabulary is. When I read other people's books or the newspaper in the morning, all I can think is, fuck, I know, like, 300 words. So, I hope you've enjoyed those words, or at least the 299 of them that weren't fuck. This is Anna Faris. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Unqualified, Love and Relationship Advice from a Celebrity Who Just Wants to Help. This program was directed by Fred Sanders. Executive producer, Linda Korn. Text copyright 2017 by Unqualified Media, LLC. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.